other evidences, other theories, alternative theories, right? We've debunked them pretty much, and we said, though, the last theory standing is, of course, what? Resurrection. And then we talked about circumstantial evidence. And now I'd just like to add in the prophecy piece, okay? And again, sometimes these are things we know, but it's nice that when we take things and we kind of put them in an order to see how we can stack them together to make a case, all right? So sometimes we know things, you know, here and there, but we don't necessarily put them in a nice, neat order that we could then, let's say, talk through, okay? So I'd like to do a little bit of that today, okay? And by the way, if you really, of course, if you really want to go way down deep with this, this is very much a Josh McDowell thing. He's very good at this in New Evidence That Demands a Verdict, More Than a Carpenter. If you read Josh McDowell books, you notice that there's a lot of the same stuff showing up again and again, like a ready defense and Evidence That Demands a Verdict and the New Evidence That Demands a Verdict are all overlapping quite a bit, but he's good with this. So, all right, so here we go. One of the reasons, magic button. Oh, I see. I got to stand over here. Craig is an impediment to the magic button. That's okay. That's all right. We just learned something about the technology, huh? Right. Craig, no, it's fine. Okay. One of the things we find, I'm just teasing Craig. One of the things we find in the New Testament is both Jesus and then New Testament writers appealing to what as evidence for Jesus? Prophecy, right? Even after, right? In Luke, right? He says, was it not necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and then enter his glory? In other words, they are continually, both Jesus and New Testament writers, right, appealing to Jesus as the fulfillment of prophecy. And that's rather unique, okay? Excuse me. Josh McDowell says, the Old Testament contains 60 major messianic prophecies and approximately 270 ramifications. And again, you'll see different numbers on this. It depends on what people consider a prophecy or something that's connected to another prophecy. The number is not something to get hung up on. But it's a whole bunch, okay? All right? Here in Luke, Jesus says, these are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things which are written about me in the law of Moses, Old Testament, and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. So Jesus is very actively saying, look, I'm the guy, right? And everything in the Old Testament points to me. Now, you should know there are a lot of other false messiahs that have cropped up over time. And they weren't able to appeal to what? Prophecy. Because they didn't fit the description given in the Old Testament. Jesus could do it because he did fit the description in the Old Testament, okay? In John, he says, but if you had believed Moses, you would have believed me because he wrote about me, okay? Now, that's a heck of a claim to make unless you're what? Right, okay? Because there's a very specific picture that is formulated in the Old Testament, okay? In John, further in John 8, he says, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. Okay, so Jesus is very unequivocally talking about himself as the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. Again, a dangerous game to play unless you're right. Okay? Okay, you get the idea. All right, so not only is Jesus saying it, right, in the book of Acts, right, we see Luke writing about it, okay, and Paul going about preaching it, and so on, okay? And then, of course, our favorite passage probably for the whole course, which is what? 1 Corinthians, right, 15, 3 through 8. This is 3 through 4, right? And where Paul says, I received it and passed it on. I passed on to you what was most important and what had also been passed on to me. Christ died for our sins just as the scriptures said. He's talking about what? Old Testament scriptures. He's writing this in 55 AD. He is not talking about something in the New Testament. That's not a thing yet. Okay? He's in the business right now of writing part of the New Testament. Okay? He was buried and he was raised from the dead on the third day, as the scriptures said. He is appealing, right, to their knowledge of the Old Testament as evidence for Jesus' messiahship. Okay? Okay. So there were about 40 false messiahs, okay? Only one, Jesus, could go around or tried to go around saying, listen, I'm the guy and here's why, and appeal to prophecy to do it. And there's reasons, because he was the guy and he could do it. So let's look at, and one of the things I love about McDowell is McDowell does it as sort of, he talks about writing an address for the Messiah in the Old Testament. And what I want to see is if you stack it together, you could sort of narrow it down to this one guy, okay? So way back in Genesis, you get the first, what's considered the first messianic prophecy in the Bible, and that is this notion of the seed of the woman, right, bruising the head of the serpent, or basically the seed of the woman coming along and putting Satan down, basically. Genesis 3:15 says, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. This is pretty much the only part we ever see where somebody is identified as what? The seed of the woman. Everybody else is always charted through what? The man, right? Christ, by virtue of his what? Virgin birth, is literally what? The seed of the woman. So if all that stuff about Jesus, which is recorded in Matthew and Luke about the virgin birth, is true, right? If that miraculous thing happened once, right? And by the way, Christians aren't claiming that this normally happens, right? Christians aren't claiming resurrection normally what happens. We're claiming that a all-powerful God can intercede and do miraculous stuff if he wants to. We're not saying this is normal. If it were normal, we wouldn't be so excited about it. Okay? All right? But basically, this basically says the seed of the woman is going to be what grinds Satan underfoot, whoever that is. Okay? Okay, so first thing, the Messiah must be what? Seed of the woman. Okay. Second thing. Boy, magic button. Okay. Second thing. We're skipping through here. Noah, there's a giant flood. There are eight people on the ark. There's Noah, Mrs. Noah, three sons, and their three wives. Right? All people are descended in the biblical account from what? Those three sons and their wives, okay? In the Old Testament, right, God removes two of those and says that the Messiah must be through whose line? Huh? Shem, very good, okay? I'm going to stand over here. The magic button's not helping me, okay? So not only must the Messiah be the seed of the woman, he must be of the lineage of Shem, okay? Okay. Fast forward a little bit, right, to my favorite place, a land called Ur, which, by the way, we've archaeologically, that was a pretty thriving place. Like, we've dug it up, you know, and it turns out that region in that time period was pretty cosmopolitan, okay? He was getting away from, you know, a very developed society when he left, okay? Abraham is called. Right? And in multiple places, right, God says that the Messiah will be descended from Abraham, that the world will be blessed through Abraham's descendant. So the Messiah has to be what? Seed of a woman, from the line of Shem, now from the line of Abraham. How many sons does Abraham have? Two. Who are they? Well, okay. Okay. Two that were relevant here, right? Yeah. Okay. Ishmael and Isaac, right. Okay. So Abraham is the guy, and that's in multiple locations in the Old Testament, and then his two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. Okay. Of the two, the Old Testament says that the Messiah will come out of the line of Isaac. So there's this gradual narrowing, and you're going to see it gets narrower and narrower. That is a hard word. I will not say that word again in any future talk we ever have. That is tough. Okay, so we got seed of the woman, Shem, Abraham, and Isaac. Okay, how many sons does Isaac have? Two. Esau and Jacob. Which is the relevant guy of Esau and Jacob? Jacob, okay. Okay, so far we got seed of a woman, lineage of Shem, descended from Abraham, and from Isaac, okay? And now, if you go, and again, we're going to look at a couple of the prophecies, but we're not going to look, we can't obviously dive into the actual text of everything here. But in multiple places in the Old Testament, it says that Jacob is the guy. So now we've got seed of the woman, right? Lineage of Shem, Abraham, Isaac, of Jacob. Okay. Jacob has 12 sons, right? Those are the ones that become the basis for the 12 tribes of what? Israel. Okay. There are 11 of them that are not relevant here. Which is the relevant one when we talk about messianic prophecy? Judah. Okay. So far we've got seed of the woman, Shem, Abraham, Isaac, of Isaac, right? Jacob, now of Jacob, of Judah. Okay? So 11/12 of those tribes are gonzo. It's getting pretty narrow already, okay? It has to be the tribe of Judah. That word Judah, of course, is where we get our word what? Jew from, okay? So we had Hebrews, then Israelites, right? I mean, technically speaking, when we say the Israelites, we don't say the Jews fled Egypt, right? We say the what? Israelites fled Egypt, and then we have a tribe called Judah, and then over time, after some invasions and this, that, and the other thing, right, eventually we start talking about anybody of that descent as Jewish. But technically, it's from the word what? Judah, which is one of the tribes, okay? So seed of a woman, lineage of Shem, descended from Abraham, of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, of Judah. Well, it gets narrower than that, okay? Within Judah, he's got the line of Jesse, okay? Line of Jesse, okay? Now, Jesse has how many sons? Eight. It's eight, right? Got seven that are and then one that's out tending the sheep. Remember him? Okay, David, right? Okay, so we've got the seed of the woman, the lineage of Shem, descended from Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, of Judah, of family of Jesse, and of David. Okay? So God in the Old Testament says the Messiah has to come from David. So of his eight sons, it's got to be from the line of David. Okay? By the way, now do you start to see why in the New Testament, in two books, there's some genealogy stuff going on? Right? Because the Jewish audience understands, right, that there are very specific, or can be made to understand, that there are very specific lineage requirements for who? The Messiah, okay? So the house of David. Seed of a woman, lineage of Shem, descended from Abraham, Isaac, of Jacob, of Judah, of Jesse, and the house of David, okay? It is, yeah. Okay, so far we've got a pretty narrow address. Now, it gets better, though. And again, these are things you know, but when you start to see them together like this, you start to go, oh my goodness, this is just a gradual, what, narrowing of the funnel, right? Okay? The Messiah, this is real specific. According to Micah 5:2, the Messiah must be born where? In Bethlehem, which is a tiny little place, by the way. Okay? So the Messiah has to be the seed of a woman, of Shem, of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, of Judah, of Jesse, of David, and must be born where? Bethlehem. Now, by the way, if anyone were to ever say to you, well, hey, these Old Testament prophecies, by the way, this used to be somewhat fashionable to say, they're so specific, they must have been written when? After Jesus. Because it couldn't possibly be what? Before Jesus. The problem with that, you have a three-word answer, and it goes like this, Dead Sea Scrolls. Because the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Qumran community outside of Jerusalem, right, we know that those are from the 1st century and 2nd century B.C. Which means what? Yeah, which means that Old Testament, all of it, which we have the entire thing or samples of the entire thing from that, except for the book of Esther, we know it's written, right, before Christ. So they used to say, for example, Daniel got all, you know, he's such a great prophet. It couldn't be, Daniel had to be written way later than seemingly Daniel was written because he was so right, they just couldn't get their mind around it. That went out the window with the Dead Sea Scrolls because we have a copy of Daniel. Similarly, we have an entire scroll of the entire Isaiah dating before Christ from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay? Isaiah, of course, includes things like chapter 53. Okay? So if anyone says, well, this is all written after, sorry, that's not negotiable. That is a factual error. It's not your opinion. It's just wrong. Okay? Okay. So, now we get some really cool stuff here. Okay? In Malachi 3:1 and a few other verses, we'll look at Daniel 9. The Old Testament writers assert that the Messiah has to come while the temple is still standing. Okay? By the way, when was the temple raised to the ground by the Romans? 70 AD. That is a historical fact, like, you know, the Nazis invaded Poland in 1939. That happened. So the temple has to be there. The Messiah has to come before the temple gets leveled. Okay? And that's in multiple places. Let's take a look at one of them here. Okay. In Daniel 9:26, it says, then after 62 weeks, and that word weeks is the Hebrew word Shabuah, which is more like sevens, which means more like 7 years. If you start doing, there's a whole mathematical thing you can do with that, but we won't do it right now. But basically it says, after 62 periods of 7 years, really, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. Cut off is a fancy schmancy way of saying what? Killed. It says all throughout the Old Testament the Messiah is going to suffer, that he's going to get killed. It says it here, okay? And the people of the prince who is to come, Romans, will destroy the what? City. What city? Jerusalem. And the sanctuary. What sanctuary? The temple. And its end will come with a flood. Even to the end there will be war. Desolations are determined. So basically this says, timeline is Messiah shows up. Messiah gets what? Killed. Then eventually, sometime after that, temple is what? Destroyed. Jesus showed up. Jesus got what? Killed. Temple destroyed when? And the city, by the way, 70 AD. Okay? So if you're still waiting for him to show up for the first time, the requirement according to the Old Testament in the book of Daniel, among other places, by the way, Daniel was written before Christ. Why? Dead Sea Scrolls, okay? If you're still waiting for him to show up for the first time, he had to have shown up before 70 AD, period. Okay? So the temple will be standing when the Messiah shows up, okay? So he has to be, just to summarize so far, seed of a woman, the lineage of Shem, descended from Abraham of Isaac of Jacob, Jacob of Judah, Judah Jesse, Jesse's sons, 8 sons, got to be David, born in Bethlehem, and must be showing up before the destruction of the temple. Chris? Ephrathah. Yeah, there's two. Yeah, you're right. It specifies which Bethlehem, right? It specifies which Bethlehem, just in case. Okay. Now, there's a few things, well, there's a lot of things, but a few more things here that is in the address sort of this Messiah. This Messiah will be rejected, and rejected specifically by his own people, okay? He will be believed in part by the Gentiles, which is in a number of places in the Old Testament, including Isaiah and the Psalms, okay? So this Messiah is going to be cast aside by his own people and in part accepted by not his own people, which of course is precisely what happened to Jesus, isn't it? Okay? Okay. He is also going to be preceded by a forerunner. And in the New Testament, of course, we see his cousin. Remember all his cousins? This is cousin on the other side, right? Not the fisherman side, right? John the Baptist, right? The voice crying in the wilderness, who precedes him. Okay? So there are also a few real specific things. As it goes on, it gets, I think, even more specific. Okay, so in Matthew 27:3-10, Matthew basically identifies a few prophecies that are really specific about this particular, this Messiah, okay? And they show up, we're going to look at first the Matthew passage and then look at least one of the Old Testament passages. So Matthew basically says, talking about Judas, when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. I have sinned, he said, for I have betrayed innocent blood. And of course, their response is, what is that to us? They replied, that's your responsibility. Okay? So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. The chief priest picked up the coins and said, it's against the law to put this into the treasury since it's blood money. And again, displaying this incredibly ironic concern they have for procedure while they're plotting to, like, murder a guy. They're worried about, like, whether the body will stay on the cross on the Sabbath, but they're not concerned about the whole murder thing. So they decided to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. That's why it's been called the Field of Blood to this day. Then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 pieces of silver, the price set on him by the people of Israel, so they used him to buy the potter's field as the Lord commanded me. Okay. Psalm 41:9 simply, and again, this is a messianic prophecy identified by all scholars as a messianic prophecy, says, even my close friend, someone I trusted, one who shared my bread, has turned against me. Talking about the Messiah, okay? In Zechariah, and this is what Matthew's referring to, okay? I told them, this is Old Testament again. That was New Testament, Matthew talking about what did happen, right? This is Old Testament, Zechariah. I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. Now, when Zechariah is written, the currency in vogue at the time is not silver, it's what? Gold. Okay? Not only is Zechariah, and again, we know Zechariah is written when? Before Christ, and how do we know that? Dead Sea Scrolls, okay? Zechariah here, it's not only silver, it's how much? 30 pieces, okay? And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter. Flashback to Matthew, right? The 30 pieces of silver, since it's blood money, can't be put in the temple treasury. It's used to buy what? Potter's field, okay? So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them to the potter at the house of the Lord. Threw them into the house of the Lord, which is, of course, what? The temple. Matthew records Judas as what? Throwing the money on the temple floor. That's crazy specific. So you have this written before Christ, undeniably written before Christ, and then you have events in the New Testament recorded in Matthew. And you say, well, how do I know Matthew got it right? Well, you know Matthew got it right because of the things we went through earlier, which is what? Every time we fact check the Gospels on little dippy things that don't seem to matter, they come out what? Correct. Right? And again, once you establish something as historically reliable, you're going to have to work to make it not historically reliable. So if Matthew and John and Luke keep getting the names of leaders right, the names of ports right, whether there's five windows in a pool right, and all these things, if they get all that stuff right that doesn't really matter, right? It's not that big a deal. Then you're going to have to work to prove the opposite, that they're wrong about the bigger stuff. And by the way, all I'm saying is basic historical procedure, okay? Once something has been established as historically credible, and they are historically credible every time you can fact check them, right? Then you have to prove the opposite after you've established them historically credible. You don't just get to say, well, he's right about all of this stuff. He gets everything right, painstakingly right. But then when it comes to something I don't like, I'm just going to say what? Not historically credible. You don't get to do that. That's not how historians work when they're being honest, okay? Okay, so not only is the Messiah what? Seed of a woman, Shem, Abraham of who? Isaac of who? Jacob. Of Jacob of who? Judah. Of Judah of who? Jesse. Of Jesse of who? David. Okay, not only is he that lineage, he's born where? Bethlehem, and he's got to show up before what? The temple and Jerusalem are destroyed. And not only that, he's going to get betrayed by a friend. The friend is going to betray him for how much? 30 pieces of silver. The friend who betrays him is going to take that money and throw it where? On the temple floor. Okay?
And another will take his place.
And another will take his place, which of course then does happen when they have a vote to see who replaces Judas. Yeah. Okay? Very good. Okay. Not to mention the potter's field, okay, which is also that idea of throw it to the potter is in Zechariah as well, okay? Okay, so he's rejected by Jews, believed by Gentiles, has a forerunner, okay, he's betrayed. Betrayed for what? 30 pieces of silver, which will then be thrown down on the temple floor by the friend that betrayed him, okay? And so it's a really specific address, a really specific address. Okay, now, if we go back to the Old Testament again, and again, there's more that is not in this particular presentation, but here's a good one, okay? There is a multiple prophecies, but this particular one dictating that the Messiah's hands and feet will be pierced and he will be crucified, okay? Now, that is particularly interesting since at the time of writing this, right, there would have been really no way for the author who's writing this to know about what? Crucifixion, all right? So that's pretty neat in and of itself, okay? So let's take a look. Come on, magic button. Okay, Psalm 22, 6 through 18, okay, talking about the Messiah, but I am a worm and not a man, scorned by everyone, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. Now we think back, of course, to the scene at the cross, right? Where they're mocking him, saying, look, he saved others. Why can't he come down and what? Save himself, prove to us. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him since he delights in him. Virtually mirroring the things that Jesus' enemies say about him at the cross. And again, this is written undeniably before what? Christ. Just is. Okay? Yet you brought me out of the womb, you made me trust in you, even at my mother's breast. From birth I was cast on you, from my mother's womb you have been my God. Do not be far from me, for trouble is near, and there's no one to help. Many bulls surround me, strong bulls of Bashan encircle me, roaring lions that tear their prey open their mouths wide against me. I am poured out like water. Now what do we recall? Medical evidence from John, right? And we said this was great evidence of Jesus' death on the cross, right? We said that when the spear thrust goes into the side here, the pericardial fluid, right, which is basically what? Water, it's clear fluid, is going to come out separate from what? The blood. Whereas if the heart is still beating, you're going to get a pulse of what? A mixture, right? So we get from John, the fisherman, right, not the cardiologist, right? From John, we get this description, this medically accurate description of blood and water separately. The only way that he could have done that is he was there, right? There's no way for him to guess that. And so here in Psalm 22, a thousand years before, he says, I'm poured out like water and all my bones are out of what? Joint. Well, one of the really nasty things about crucifixion, and of course there are many nasty things about crucifixion, but one of the other nasty things about crucifixion is what? You have a great chance of dislocating your shoulders, right? It is stretching you literally to the breaking point, okay? Here's my favorite. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted within me. Literally the stress of crucifixion, right? Not to put too fine a point on it, but it literally can rupture the heart. So this is poetic language. Of course, it's not literally turning to wax. We get that, okay? But the idea is literally you can have a rupture of the heart. So this is 1,000 years before, talking about the Messiah, saying what's going to happen to him in a time when there really is no crucifixion to speak of, right? And this messianic prediction is saying that the Messiah is going to be poured out like water, dislocations, and ruptured heart. All of which is perfectly fine if you took a look at the medical aspects of crucifixion. Okay? My mouth is dried up like a potsherd. Oh, wait a minute. Of course, on the cross, what does Jesus ask for? Right? He's thirsty, right? Which is logical. Anybody in that position would be, right? My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet. Okay? Again, the author in 1000 or so BC does not have access, right, to crucifixion as a point of reference. And yet he's describing, medically speaking and physically, crucifixion of who? The Messiah. All my bones are on display. People stare and what? Gloat at me. They divide my clothes among them. Wow, that's pretty specific. All right, we know from, again, our historically reliable gospels that the soldiers, the guys, the four guards, right, and we know there are four because they divide it four ways, are gambling for what? His clothing, dividing his clothes, and then gambling for the seamless garment they don't want to rip up. So we have an account, more than one account, of the soldiers doing what they normally did, which is take the guy's stuff, right? Well, here it's predicted 1,000 years earlier. So in this one passage, right, we have someone who's thirsty, hands and feet pierced, right, poured out like water pouring out of him, right, heart rupturing, bones dislocating, people standing around him and what? Mocking him. You understand now why people would read this and go, that had to have been written when? After. That had to have been written after. How could they possibly get this and the gambling for the clothes, right? How could they possibly get that right 1,000 years before? This has to be a fraud. Problem again is what? Say it, Dead Sea Scrolls. It's not written after, it's written before. So if anyone says that to you, sorry, that's just not true. So this, I would say, is incredibly specific. So far we've got a Messiah that has to be what? Seed of the woman, line of Shem, from Shem who? Abraham, from Abraham who? From Isaac who? From Jacob who? Judah, from Judah who? From Jesse who? David, he has to be born where? What has to be still standing when he shows up? Okay, what's his friend gonna do to him? Betray him, okay, for how much? Okay, what's gonna happen to that 30 pieces of silver? Thrown on the temple floor, okay? And now we have these, and by the way, this is not the only one. You're familiar with Isaiah 53, right? Okay? This is not the only really intense physical description of what's going to happen to the Messiah. And I would point out once again, at a time when the author does not have a reference point of crucifixion. That's a pretty amazing medical description of what happens to you in crucifixion by a guy, right, who doesn't have access to that. And even if he did, right, his ability to look inside and see, you know, hearts rupturing and stuff, that's pretty tricky too, okay? Okay, so he's rejected by the Jews, he's believed by the Gentiles, he's got a forerunner, okay? He's betrayed by a friend for 30 pieces of silver, and he is crucified, okay? The description of crucifixion is written 800 years before the Romans used crucifixion. Now, there are other variants on, you know, crucifixion floating, you know, but not when the guy's writing, okay? He is describing Roman crucifixion, and he is describing not only Roman crucifixion, but Roman crucifixion plus gambling for clothes, which is my favorite part. The gambling for clothes, that's what the four guards did, okay? I don't know how you get around that one, okay? Okay, so Josh McDowell says, the precise lineage, the place, time, and manner of birth, people's reactions, the betrayal, the manner of death. Magic button, what is wrong with you? Okay. These are merely a fraction of the hundreds of details that make up the address to identify God's Son, the Messiah, the Savior of the world. It's no wonder Jesus and the apostles appealed to fulfilled prophecies to substantiate his claim he was the Son of God because, well, he could. You understand, if he weren't of the lineage of David, right, all of this, what, falls apart. If this hadn't happened the way it happened, right, then the Old Testament address doesn't fit him, but the Old Testament address fits him to a T. And you say, well, and people have said this, so we got to deal with it, maybe all of that was just a what? Coincidence. Okay? I teach middle school, I don't believe in coincidences. Okay? All right? So let's see mathematically how that works out. There's a guy years ago named Professor Stoner. You say, well, he must have been at Berkeley. No, not that kind of Stoner. That's his last name. Okay. There's a guy, he was at Illinois. Okay? And he and his grad students, and I'm not even going to attempt to explain the math, okay? I don't think I could, and I don't think you want me to, okay? But he wrote a book on it, I have it somewhere, okay, where they go to how they did this, okay? And basically what they did is they used probability models to try to assess what's the likelihood of a certain number of prophecies being fulfilled in one man. And they used two. They used eight, and then they used 48. Okay? So let's just look at eight. What they did is they said, we're going to take eight of these prophecies. And by the way, they've got to be prophecies that Jesus couldn't, like, have control over. Like, for example, there's a couple, like, the idea that the Messiah is going to ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, basically. Like, Jesus could influence that, right? So you don't want that one because that skews the model. Everybody get that? Okay, so you want stuff like born in Bethlehem, right? Can Jesus affect being born in Bethlehem? No. Okay, so they took eight, okay? And basically they calculated that the chance that somebody could randomly, meaning coincidentally, right, fulfill just eight. And remember, there are, depending on how you slice it, you know, 300 some odd prophecies about the Messiah, okay? Just eight. It's 1 in 10 to the 17th. Now, what that means is a 1 with 17 zeros after it. By the time you start using numbers instead of, like, billions and trillions, you're into some serious zeros. Okay, so you say, well, okay, what does that chance look like functionally in real life? I'm so glad you asked. Okay. Take a silver dollar, mark it with a red X, and then what you're going to do, if you can, and if they allow you, okay, is you're going to get silver dollars so that you can cover the state of Texas. You're going to cover Texas in silver dollars 2.5 feet deep. Somewhere in that pile of silver dollars covering Texas 2.5 feet deep is your silver dollar with the red X. You're going to blindfold yourself, get in a helicopter, fly low, jump out somewhere in Texas. You get to reach down once with your blindfold on and grab the one with the red X. The chance you have of getting the one with the red X is the same chance of somebody fulfilling eight prophecies in the Old Testament coincidentally. So if someone says, hey, it's just a coincidence, I'm sorry, that's laughable. By the way, that's with eight. Okay? Stoner also calculated what you would do if you were going to try to use 48. 48 comes out to 1 in 10 to the 157th power. Now, you say, well, that's a big number beyond which I can really think about. Well, of course it is. It's an insanely big number. Just to give you an understanding of how big a number that is, the estimates for number of atoms in the universe is 10 to the 80th. And you understand every time you put another number on there, you're adding a what? A zero. So 10 to the 81st is way bigger than 10 to the what? 80th. 10 to the 82nd is way bigger than 10 to the 81st and so on. This is 10 to the 157th. Okay? So this would be many, many, many thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of universes worth of atoms, right? That's what we're talking about here. So to try to come up with an illustration, and I've seen a couple done, one involves getting in a spaceship and again having like an atom marked with a red X and going through multiple, but that's kind of weird. So here's the illustration we have for today, okay? An electron is a tiny little thing. Just an inch line of electrons. If you were to count electrons for an inch, and you counted 250 per minute, which is really fast counting, by the way, right? How long do you think it would take you to count an inch line of electrons, 250 per minute? Well, I'm glad you said that. 19 million years. Good job. Okay. A long time. Okay. That's what I'm saying. You start playing with these numbers. Like, how do you even start thinking about them? I don't know. Like, we kind of max out at, like, I don't know what, 100 people or something like that. You say a million. What does that even mean? You know, you start talking about 19 million years and 10 to the 157th is tough. Well, if you took a cubic inch of electrons, that would be 19 million times 19 million times 19 million years, okay? Now, the illustration is, let's take a cubic box, I guess if you will, of electrons, which it took us this long to count, right? And again, you get your blindfold. This time you have to use a really tiny red pen, because you're marking one of the electrons with what? Red X. And you get your one, you don't need the helicopter this time, right? But this time you get one chance to pick the right what? Electron. The odds of you doing that are the same as the odds of coincidentally fulfilling 48 of the Old Testament prophecies by chance. So if someone says, well, Jesus could have fulfilled these prophecies, like being born of Bethlehem, like having the perfect lineage, like being alive before the and dying before the temple was destroyed, right? Like being betrayed by a friend, getting crucified in a particular manner, right? Like having people gamble for his clothes. If he says, well, this is just coincidental. The math is not on your side, okay? You're in a universe with 10 to the 80th atoms, okay? And that's so much more, okay? So coincidence is not a very good argument. What a much better argument is, God wrote a specific address for his Messiah, and then he showed up and fulfilled it. That's a way better explanation than coincidence, okay? Okay, where's my timekeeper? How are we doing? Okay. They blocked my clock. They took this. That. I didn't know if I was supposed to sing today or what I was supposed to. I was so confused when I showed up. What? We're good? Okay. All right. So this is, just for those of you that walked in later, this is the last class for this round, okay? I don't have any more for now, okay? So we'll probably, depending what Pastor Steve wants to do at some point, maybe in the winter or something, we'll fire something else up and do a different angle on something. But right now, that's all we have, okay? So let's, Rich, can you take us out and pray us out, please?
Oh, Heavenly Father.